This is Michael Kaiser, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast. Today's episode is part of a series of conversations we recorded at the Shelton Brothers Festival back in August in Atlanta. A phenomenal gathering of some of the best brewers in the world, as well as a few niche cider and winemakers, all holding their own in one of the most diverse and interesting product portfolios that's ever been assembled. The folks from Shelton Brothers gave us a room and free rein to curate talks with anyone we wanted on any topics we wished. It's a somewhat speedy series of interviews, much shorter than you're used to on GBH, and that's because we wanted to see if a series of topics might emerge, a pattern of sorts, that might give us an indication of what's on people's mind at this point in time in this particular portfolio of producers. And I think it kind of worked. Also, on a few of these episodes, you'll hear from a couple of other folks from GBH that drop in from time to time, so you might hear from Blake Tyers and Kyle Kastronik as well. This episode features Todd Barra of Hunta Flora Brewery in North Carolina. Listen in. All right, well, let's start. Let's get people to know your voices. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hello, my name is Todd, Fonta Flora Brewery.
Right on. And Kyle?
Hello, this is Kyle.
Yeah. So you might have heard Kyle on a different segment where I didn't introduce him. I just let him pop in and ask questions, like a third party.
Oh, good.
So if that voice sounds familiar to you, you might remember all of his peas popping. That was him. That was Kyle Kastronik, our writer from Ohio.
Popping
peas. Joining
us
for this one. Popping peas.
We might have similar things going on. I'm from Cleveland, so.
Is that right?
Yep.
Pea popping up there?
Always popping the peas.
What did you guys bring to the festival today? What are you pouring?
We try to bring a lot of our funky stuff for these things, which is kind of a struggle sometimes because you're just like, we'd really like to bring some, you know, maybe a session IPA or an IPA or something different. But, you know, a lot of people don't tend to care about that stuff other than brewers. But first session today, we had some green bottle magnums of a funky mixed culture table saison, all stainless steel, primary mixed culture fermentation. It's really cool. The green bottles, it's gotten really nice and light struck. So it's,
we got to talk about this.
Yeah.
I haven't had a chance to dive into this with anybody yet.
Yeah. Cool.
But this intentionally light struck green bottle thing, that I think probably gives Ray Daniels aneurysms on a daily basis.
That's my favorite thing. I hope it does. Yeah.
What's going on there? What are you trying to achieve? What is the intent behind that?
Basically that. And I mean, really, it's just sort of experimentation too, right? I mean, it's not like, you know, we do that to every beer or anything, but some beers, I particularly like that skunky profile. Like I grew up, you know, stealing my dad's Heineken, you know, when I was a kid and like, you know, kind of chugging that and just kind of always really appreciated that, you know, light struck quality. And whether they intended it to be or not, you know, just a lot of the, you know, traditional Belgian saisons, you know, just kind of like really falling in love with that profile, you know, again, whether or not it was, you know, they intended that to be part of their profile originally, like kind of ended up being a part of a lot of breweries' profiles. Yeah. So
I remember when Jester King first did it, and mm-hmm. I was on a podcast with Ray and a couple other folks on the Beer Temple. Ray was making a case that of all the off flavors, all of which have some sort of natural occurrence in nature that we can associate with, so that even if it's not good within beer production, we don't necessarily always interpret it as bad. Buttery is a perfect example.
Sure.
We love buttery things. In a beer, it's not supposed to be there,
mm-hmm.
so it's not so far-fetched that when somebody tastes, you know, butter in their beer, that it's not necessarily a turn off for everybody.
Sure.
But skunkiness was the one thing he just wouldn't let it go because it doesn't occur in nature in a way that would be attractive to humans. And I tried to make a case inelegantly, perhaps, that it doesn't matter if it occurred naturally, it occurred in our cultural history as beer drinkers.
Sure.
And so it is therefore part of our, like, our taste memory. And that's enough.
Yeah.
For absolutely. That to become intentional.
It's such a strange argument for him to make. And it's also such a strange thing to like hold so like steadfast on. It's just like, it's a part of, like you said, like it's a part of history. It's a part of a lot of different like breweries, like beer profiles, and people have come to really like it. Some people like Ray Daniels, you know, certainly hate it. But yeah, I think it's a flavor. It exists, and you know, you can make the decision for yourself if you like it or not. And it just seems there's so much trying to be like black and white with like with beer, like aromas or tastes, so many profiles. It's just like fermentation is a gnarly, gnarly thing. And then how it's aged is even, you know, crazier. And so like things happen that we don't necessarily, you know, like maybe it wasn't intended, maybe it was, but it's just like, that's the flavor of that given beer. And like, let the consumer, you know, decide if they like that as a flavor.
Is there anything that you're irrationally against? Where do you take irrational stands? You strike me as somebody who might.
Thank you. Yeah. I don't think anything like so much as like that's something that's accepted as an aroma in or a flavor in beer. I mean, you know, I'm certainly sensitive to certain off flavors. If that's what we're like specifically talking about, that I would like.
We can broaden it a little bit. Like, how do you feel about kettle sours?
There we go. I like that.
did we get right
yeah,
to
I like
it?
Yeah, thank you. That's good. You know, I think kettle sours have a place. You know, here's the thing. It's like, I think if you looked back in the day, potentially at how a lot of Berliners or how a lot of Gozas, you know, were produced, like anything, it's like the path, it's a pathway. Everything wants to like turn sour, really. I mean, it's just like pathways of fermentation. Wine wants to be vinegar. Beer wants to also be vinegar. Like, this is just things that's going to happen. So, you know, I think probably some of the, you know, the earlier Berliners and Gozas, you know, they're probably all sour mashed, you know, and so it's like, is there a difference between sour mash and is there a difference between kettle souring? You know, it's kind of like, you know, using similar methods to like achieve the same end goal. The issue that I have with kettle souring is saying that it's something that it's not. So like passing off kettle soured beer as, you know, something where a lot of breweries are like taking a really long time to, you know, create intentional, like, you know, mixed culture, barrel aged sour beers, you know, it's a very different thing. And to a lot of consumers, you know, seeing like, you know, an $8 six pack Goza that was kettle soured, you know, on a shelf, but then they see like, you know, say like, you know, Jester King, like the Spawn stuff, you know, and they're just like, why the fuck is that beer like $30 a bottle and I can buy, you know? So it's, I think it's problematic for the consumer more than, and for the brewery because of the consumer and not understanding the difference between the two. So I just think transparency should be involved, but we don't kettle sour anything at the brewery. It's all mixed culture fermentation.
Yeah,
for sure.
I don't think there's a brewery out there that has more of the approach embedded in the name of the brewery as much as you guys do. Like Fonta Flora, just those words together tell such a great story about what you're interested in.
I mean, cool. Yeah, that's awesome to hear. Which, you know, certainly wasn't the intention, you know, starting out. I mean, we chose that name. It was a sunken city, you know, nearby where we live, you know, and so it was just like really fitting culturally, you know, for us. And then it did kind of blossom into like really being synonymous with our kind of core values as a brewery.
Yeah. And so, even just the word, you know, it just brings up this like romantic notion, I think, about like many of the ingredients you're using and the process by which you get there, which are all very natural and sort of romantic about like how those things occur at a microbiological level, but also sure. The things that you're going out and getting and using as ingredients.
Yeah.
Yesterday at the Porter Bar, I had one of your beet sours.
Cool.
And what just a lovely expression of a beet, because on the nose it smells like it's almost going to taste like kimchi. Like there's a little bit of that like acid sharpness
for
to
sure
it. And then you get in there and it's just like this soft vegetal sweetness almost like from a rhubarb
for
and
sure.
What a beautiful combination that was to yeah. Set you up and then surprise you just a little yeah. Bit differently.
Yeah
Like I don't know, there's just something about that that just sounds like that Fonta and Flora, like just kind of being expressed through that beer is great.
Sure. Yeah, thanks man. That beer is I don't know, it's obviously when you look at it, it's strikingly beautiful. So it's just like this weird, it's almost actually confusing for a lot of people because they see it and they assume it's going to be some like, you know, fruited sour, fruited something. And it's just like, oh, what the fuck? This is beets. And people love it or people hate it. So it's certainly a weird one for us to like, and we, you know, we make it, you know, twice a year, you know, in the spring and in the fall, you know, when we're getting, you know, fresh beets in. So yeah, it's, yeah, that one's really cool.
It's cool
for sure.
Yeah, and I sat in on your panel at CBC, and I thought of all the panels that I went to, it was really captivating, and the people that I talked with, there seemed to be a lot of almost whimsy involved there as far as this idea of going out and foraging for the ingredients, mm-hmm. and not only that idea of collecting local things, but finding enough local things to fill the quantity that you need to.
Sure.
And I think, you know, this idea of a terroir and beer is a little bit stretched at this point, but I think what you're doing really contributes to that aspect a little bit. So can you talk a little bit about how that plays a role in what Fonta's doing?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that is the easily the driving force of, you know, of how we brew beer and why we brew beer. You know, kind of my background, I have a degree in sustainable agriculture. So it was that's when I was homebrewing a lot also when I was in college. So like the first beers I was making, you know, I was working on, I went to a really weird college, sustainable agriculture degree, and has a working farm. So I was, you know, I worked on the farm there. And so it was like the first beers that I was making when I was homebrewing, you know, it was like the first pumpkin ale that I made was with pumpkins that I grew on the farm and, you know, harvesting hops that I was growing. And
man, that'll change your expectations.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jeez.
So, you know, I think it's just inherently coming at it from a different perspective, I think, you know, it's just like approaching beer from an agricultural perspective, which, I mean, I just think that's how everybody should approach it, because bottom line, it's agricultural. And so, unfortunately, it's become very much, you know, a commodity. And with becoming a commodity, it's, you know, gone through all sorts of shifts, you know. So it's first and foremost for us, it's just like, you know, we're lucky enough to live and, you know, and have our brewery in a state, in an area where there's, you know, just tons of stuff to use. So it almost just seems kind of like a travesty not to use it. And, you know, in a way, like, people could look at it as like, oh, like, that's a really good, like, marketing scheme or something. And it's just like, turns out it is, but it's just like, it's not why we started doing it from day one, you know, but it does kind of help separate us from the, you know, the boatloads of other breweries. And it's wild to me that even as more breweries come on the scene, you know, they're still buying, like, you know, fruit purees from across the country and, like, not utilizing their local maltster and everything. And, like, you know, we don't pretend to use local ingredients and everything. Like, we make IPAs. I love drinking, you know, IPA is one of my favorite styles to drink. So we make IPAs and trying to, like, hone that in. And we don't use, we use no local ingredients in those beers. You know, and we advertise that. We say that on our board, you know, like, if you come into our tap room, our, you know, our draft list is, you know, if it's local, if the beer is brewed with local ingredients, it'll have a heart next to it. So, you know, we're really transparent about what beers, you know, we're using, you know, local ingredients in. It's a really important thing too. And I think it's also an important scope, kind of like you mentioned, of like actually getting enough ingredients to, like, make it worthwhile. Like, why are we putting these, you know, whatever the ingredient may be in the beer, and is it for marketing? Is it for, you know, is it for show? Is it for, you know, whatever? Is it actually supposed to, like, represent what that ingredient, you know, is? And so, you know, so we try to be, you know, if it has, like, you know, one tiny portion of, like, local ingredients in it, we're not going to advertise it as local, you know? So it's like, when we're putting that heart next to those beers, it's like, you know, the beer is really entirely local for the most part. So that's a huge thing for us. And, you know, I think we've gotten this reputation as, like, this crazy foraging brewery, and, like, part of that,
you can't be angry
true
about that.
No, it's like, it's dope, but then you, like, have conversations with, you know, like, the folks from scratch, and you're just like, mind blown, because they're just like, yeah, we're gonna go and, like, chisel this bark off of this tree, and we're gonna boil it, and we're gonna throw hot rocks in it from the granite down the, you know, it's just, it, you know, so not to compare or say that, like, one's more extreme than the next, but it's like, we've always been rooted in agriculture.
Yeah, well, I think that's the thing. It's like, things occur even within the same kind of intent. Things occur to people differently.
Yeah,
and so, like, it occurs to them to take a pot out there and start a fire and, like, throw rocks in there. And now that that's occurred to them, it will occur to other people as a result. But and I see this amongst North Carolina brewers in general, I feel like, is this appreciation of agriculture in a really just sort of, like, common way. And I see that at Full Steam,
of course,
in the way that he talks about agriculture. I know our friends at Bhavana think that way as well, and I know a lot of those people looked inspiration from you, and even the people who are solely kind of making fresh beer for now. My first Fonte Flora beer was given to me by Chris and Les from Trophy.
Yeah,
we invited them onto the podcast. They brought up a beer to the hotel room and sat it down, and they gave it to me not as this beer nerd moment, but as like we want to make sure you have this. So you understand what's going on around here.
Cool.
And that was such a cool moment to have it given to me with that kind of intent, and not in this way that they felt competitive or even beer. They just wanted, they saw that as a new benchmark that they could now start thinking about and having thoughts occurring to them.
That's crazy. That's really cool.
And it was a really great moment. I see that happening all over the place with different breweries.
What beer was that? Do you remember?
I don't remember.
Yeah.
No, I was. Man, I was drunk.
Good. So it was a great occasion.
We got into some bourbon right after that.
Yeah, yeah, that's awesome. No, those dudes are making killer beer. Yeah, really great folks.
Yeah,
for sure.
But what you're doing down there definitely seems to be inspiring a lot of people to think about. Like, things are occurring to them now that would not have occurred to them otherwise.
I think North Carolina in general is a really, you know, strong agricultural, you know, just state in a lot of transformations, you know, moving away from tobacco and, you know, a lot of other, you know, and then farmers trying to understand like what that means for them. And so there's just been like a lot of some big shifts. And so, but it's always been a very, you know, important, you know, industry in North Carolina. And so I just think, you know, and then so much culturally is related around, you know, agriculture as it is in, you know, lots of other places.
Yeah, but in different ways. Yeah. There's definitely something unique happening in North Carolina around that.
Yeah,
I live in Chicago. Illinois is a big agricultural state too.
Yeah.
But it's very different. You know, there's still a lot.
For sure.
Illinois is still predominantly, I would say, you know, energy crops. And as much of the Midwest is.
Sure.
Like Midwest. Sure. Because the Midwest's focus has always been on scale of agriculture. North Carolina has always had, like, they never seem to have lost their connection, I think, to that hyper-local agriculture. And that comes through in all, you know, everything you eat and drink there seems to have a connection to that.
And I think, you know, we certainly lucked out, right? I mean, I wouldn't be able to have done what we started out doing if it weren't for having, you know, Riverbend Malt House as our, you know, our original guy, you know, in Asheville malting grains. And so it's just like, cool, I can talk this talk and want to be brewing beer with local ingredients. But if it weren't for Riverbend, you know, making that kind of like leap of faith and being like, we're going to be a micro craft maltster in the, you know, in Asheville in the Southeast, you know, and it's just like taking that risk of like opening up, knocking on people's doors, being like, I know that you've been brewing beer a certain way with these exact ingredients for a long time, but like, you want to change? And like at that time,
you want to spend twice as much?
Exactly. And you want to spend twice as much. Yeah, damn. Exactly. That's, and it is. It's, yeah, legitimately twice as much. And,
but that's what I love about what you did. Like, because going back to what you originally said about price, you know, when we were talking about kettle sours or whatever, but there's an economy there that has to be supported. Brewers can't just go out and ask for more money. It has to demand that money, and that enables them to go further down the value chain and spend that money on things that give them more character and give them a better connection to what they're doing and more control over things like agriculture. We're not going to get to a nationally distributed malt and hop system and other fruits without people being willing to spend for it, at least in the near term. And that's a big ask. I mean, it's tough for brewers to go out there and compete on a shelf.
For sure.
While they're supporting the value chain behind them in the same way.
Absolutely. Well, and it's also every single aspect of it's more work. So, I mean, even just like take the malt away from, you know, of it for a second and even just like look at fruits. Like I have 800 pounds of plum sitting in my walk-in cooler right now that when we get back, every single pit has to be taken out of it before we can process it, before it, you know, gets blended into, you know, barrel aged sour beer. And it's just like, or you can buy fruit puree and just squeeze it on in. And it's like, so it really, and then it's like, where do you get those plums? It's taking time to connect with, you know, the farmers that grow it. And
that relationship costs time.
It's a lot of time. Making relationships and maintaining them, and, you know, just checking in the off season, just being like, how are things going, you know? And just like, and that's a really important aspect of what we do, and it feels really good to, like, I mean, for a while last year we were posting every time we bought fruit, you know, like kind of like that hokey like handshake and then like also holding the check, you know. And it was just like, you know, because like we were legitimately like buying you know, I mean, thousands and thousands of dollars of, you know, local fruit. I mean, we're a 3.5-barrel brew house right now, right. You know, so it's just like, as we expand, you know, I mean, we're talking about, you know, and I think we're making a large impact right now. And so it's like when we're, when we expand and we're brewing on a 15-barrel brew house and we're, you know, buying like, you know, a few tons every time opposed to like maybe one ton right now, it's just like, that's real money going into like these super hardworking farmers' hands. And they're just like, you know, blown away. They're just like, a lot of them don't like beer, or certainly not the beer that I'm making. They're like, wow, you're putting this in beer? And
yeah.
They like don't understand that it's just like, and they're like, wow, people line up to buy it. And it's just like, it's a really cool.
Well, the flip like side of moment. That is like you're creating a value chain that you need them to grow too.
Absolutely.
If you're going to make twice as much beer next year, you're going to need twice as much fruit. And at some point you're going to reach a limit, and then that would challenge what you're capable of doing under, you know, with your intent.
Sure.
Absolutely. And so you need those guys to be behind that.
Yep.
And see they need to see the growth.
It's refreshing seeing folks like, I mean, Allagash, I think, is just kind of a leader in everything that they do. And like, I mean, your interview with Rob Todd was super awesome. And, you know, it's just like seeing them post about stuff like buying
Million pounds of Maine grain.
It's insane. Yeah. The grain, the fruit, the scale, and then like, you know, the farm to face thing, not being like having that, you know, that issue with the peaches. You know, it's just like, it's super cool. And it's inspirational to see like someone, you know, like even though that represents a, you know, fairly small, you know, like facet of what, you know, what they're doing, like they're doing it. Like they're a big brewery and they're putting in the time to like make that happen. And it's like, that's like, you know, mad props.
I think it should give everybody hope.
Yeah.
you could do 100,000 barrels a year and you could be playing the game like that.
Yeah.
God willing.
I'm going to be happy to move up to 2,500 barrels this next year. Going to be crazy.
Thanks for joining us, man.
Yeah.
It was really a pleasure.
Yeah. Cheers. Likewise.
Thanks for listening, folks. If you'd like to hear more from this series, there are a dozen of them published on GBH right now. If you'd like to support GBH, please join the Fervent Few and be part of a productive beer community alongside brewers, fans, salespeople, writers, maltsters, just about anyone and everyone who contributes to striking conversations in beer. We use Patreon to manage our members. You can join us at patreon.com/goodbeerhunting. Aim true, pour liberal, folks. Have a great week.